I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. In 1963, Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson stood before the U.S. Senate and spoke these words: "We need a comprehensive and nationwide program to save the natural resources of America. Our soil, our water, and our air are becoming more polluted every day. Our most priceless natural resources, trees, lakes, rivers, wildlife habitats, scenic landscapes, are being destroyed." 7 years later, on April 22, 1970, Senator Nelson and activist Dennis Hayes organized the first Earth Day. Over 20 million people in the United States participated in that day of action that first year. But now, 42 years later, are we better off? How has Earth Day affected the environmental movement, for the better or for worse? Is it merely a symbol now? And what value does that symbol have? Today's guest, environmental journalist Mark Hertzgaard, recently wrote an article titled Save Earth Day. In it, he writes, Earth Day is becoming, at least in the United States, a bland, tired ritual that polluters and politicians have learned to ignore or co-opt. So is it time to retire Earth Day, or can it be reclaimed? Can it provide a real opportunity to talk about our relationship to the Earth and how we transform it? What's the most powerful way to observe Earth Day? Joining us today, as I mentioned, we have in studio Mark Hertzgaard. He's an environmental journalist and author of Hot: Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Welcome.
Hi, Holly.
And Michelle Myers is joining us by phone. She's conservation director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Sierra Club. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Holly. Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Captain Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me invite our callers to join us as well. Do you think it's time to retire Earth Day, or can it be reclaimed? If so, how? Does it provide a real opportunity to talk about our relationship to the Earth and how we transform it? Is it a useful teaching tool? And how are you changing your habits to protect the Earth? You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And I'll give that number out again a little later in the show. But let's start with you, Mark. You've written this article in The Nation called Save Earth Day. That was the inspiration for this conversation. And you say Earth Day is becoming, you know, a bland, tired ritual. And you say some environmentalists are calling for us to abolish it. Who's making those calls and why?
First time I saw that call for abolition came from Joe Rahm, who writes the excellent Climate Progress blog. And he's a scientist, and he, like others, has seen how, in some ways, Earth Day can become an excuse for thinking, okay, one day a year, we sort of pay homage to this idea of caring about the Earth, but, you know, the very same politicians who do that then turn around the next day and, you know, ignore what Earth Day would teach. In fact, as Joe pointed out this week, if you compare what Obama said on Earth Day in 2012, you'd think that that whole global warming thing, that's gone away now. He didn't mention it once. I was in Washington just before Earth Day, and I mentioned this in the piece, all around the bus stops and the metro stops there. Monsanto, the good people at Monsanto, have put up ads identifying with America's farmers and talking about how they've helped America's farmers be better environmental stewards with their products. Of course, never mentioning that they've also been suing America's farmers, at least the organic ones, who had the misfortune of having Monsanto's genetically modified seeds blown into their fields by the wind. So that kind of cynical behavior, of course, gives rise to a lot of frustration with Earth Day. But I want to be clear here. I didn't say in the piece, and nor do I believe now, that Earth Day should be shelved. It needs to be revived. I argue that it needs to go back to those radical roots of 1970, where they put so many people in the street that they scared Richard Nixon into becoming an environmental champion.
And probably the biggest environmental champion of the past three decades.
No doubt. No doubt. You know, he was a Republican president, no tree hugger, Richard Nixon. Poor guy, he wore wingtips when he walked on the beach. But he saw 10% of the American population in the streets that day. And, of course, he saw that against the backdrop of civil rights and anti-war demonstrations. And Nixon knew very well that if he wanted to run for president and win in 1972 again, that he had to defuse the environmental issue and take it away from Democrats. And so he did. He founded the EPA. You know, we have environmental impact statements today because of Richard Nixon, not because he felt like he, you know, he had some kind of a Paul on the Damascus conversion to love the earth. No, he's a calculating politician, and environmentalists need to remember that. It's not about, you know, being right. It's about having political power.
And Nixon signed the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act. But so you say, why not recall the history of Earth Day and really go back to that original vision? Can you talk a little bit more about what that would look like? What was that original vision?
Sure. And it's I should say that by way of answering that question, there's already been pushback to my piece in The Nation. And Dennis Hayes, who's someone who I've known and admired for a long time, wrote a letter to the editor, along with Chris Desser, who I also know and admire, who organized the Earth Day in 1990. And they said, hey, you know, in 1990, the Earth Day celebrations, we put a lot more people in the streets then. We revived the environment as an issue. Fair enough.
That was Redwood Summer. There was a lot going on
with
Earth
going
First.
On. Yeah. It was also 22 years ago. It's a long time ago.
So have we just gotten complacent? Do you think the political climate has changed so much that we're just not really ready for action?
No, people are ready for action. I mean, look at the Occupy movement. There's a lot of sentiment out there. And as I mentioned in another piece I have out this month in Mother Jones magazine, you know, there's a lot of activity at the grassroots. The biggest climate victory you never heard of has been won by grassroots activism. They have stopped coal, new coal plants in the United States, which are by far the biggest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions. They've been stopped by an amazing coalition of people, activists from environmental and student and labor and public health, nurses and so forth, and local public officials saying no to coal. And by the way, not in California, not in the liberal parts of the country, in the South, in the Midwest, in the heart of coal country like Kentucky. And they've been doing it through retail politics, through going and talking to their neighbors and lobbying their representatives and packing public regulatory hearings and all the boring, tedious, but vital work of retail grassroots politics. So there's clearly a lot of, I think, and I see this as I travel around the country, there's a lot of sentiment about this, but it kind of gets lost. And when it's translated into the terrain of official Washington, because at the very time that these activists were stopping coal, the media narrative that we all were talking about in the mainstream media was about how cap and trade legislation was being defeated on Capitol Hill, and which of course was a big story. But that is a terrain, i.e., official Washington, Capitol Hill, that is rigged against real progressive change. It's where big money calls the shots, and essentially big oil and big coal have what amounts to a veto over any kind of real progressive legislation, unless there is that kind of grassroots power. That's the only way that you can really move any president, even a well-meaning president like Barack Obama. They have so much pressure coming at them all the time from the polluters that unless there is enormous counter-pressure coming from grassroots people who will vote you out of office if you don't act, it's very hard for a president to show leadership.
All right, so we'll get into that more political discussion in just a moment. But let me bring Michelle and Paul into this discussion about kind of the value and the drawbacks of Earth Day and where we need to take this conversation. Why don't we start with you, Paul?
Well, Earth Day has sort of become like Christmas. You know, a lot of people think it's about Santa Claus and shopping. I think it was a good idea in the beginning, but I don't really recognize Earth Day anymore. I think every day should be Earth Day. And, you know, it's like in 1992, I remember on Earth Day we had McDonald's taking out full-page ads about what a wonderful environmental organization they were. That was the year that Gro Harlem Brundtland created the word sustainable, which has become a catchphrase for business as usual. So I do think that it's sort of outlived its its use, and we should really be looking at every day as an Earth Day.
How about you, Michelle?
Well, you know, actually, every year when I get called into, you know, attend Earth Day events and set up a table and bring petitions, I always think, you know, that's right. You know, this is such a waste of time. Every day I'm trying to actually lobby politicians to make more sound environmental policy and to really walk the walk. I think, you know, this is really taking time out of what my everyday work should be. But then when I get to Earth Day, I kind of see more of what Mark was talking about. Some of the challenges that environmentalists face and environmental activists face is really permeating the mainstream. So it depends on how you use Earth Day. This is an educational holiday, and it's a chance when people who aren't everyday activists actually say, okay, you know, I have to take some conscious effort to realize what's going on around me. And if you can reach those people, if you have an excuse to reach outside of, you know, our traditional base of environmental activists, that is extremely valuable. It helps reinvigorate our lists, you know, so you can communicate with a broader base of people. It helps you talk to folks that, you know, may not even, you know, they're busy putting food on the table for their kids, but in that moment they want to educate their child about something that they do see as valuable. And I think that the symbolism of the day helps us kind of get outside of our normal just collective of people that are living kind of the environmental lifestyle.
And that's Michelle Myers. She's Conservation Director for the San Francisco Bay Area Chapter of the Sierra Club. Tell me if I'm describing the Sierra Club correctly. It's a large mainstream environmental organization. Is that a fair definition, Michelle?
I would say we're the oldest grassroots organizing environmental organization in the nation. Being around that long might make you mainstream, but, you know, we're doing a lot of great work organizing the grassroots, including the work that Mark mentioned, shutting down coal plants across the country. I work for the San Francisco Bay Chapter. We're very lucky not to have coal plants here. So really my job is more, you know, working in coalition, bringing together different stakeholders, organizing large events, pioneering renewable energy, pushing for environmental reforms on a very local level where you can actually have impact, you know, creating better transit services, making sure that, you know, potentially there's some competition to PG&E out there that really prioritizes renewable energy. That's where we're working to really have impact.
And we're also joined by Paul Watson. He's the founder of the Sea Shepherd. And Paul, you've taken a very radical approach to your activism and had huge international, national victories all over the globe. So can you just explain a little bit about what the Sea Shepherd is and how what your approach to activism has been?
I don't really regard what we do as radical. I think we're conservative. I don't think there's anything more conservative than being a conservationist. The radicals are out here destroying the planet. Our organization was set up to stop the radicals, so we're really an anti-poaching organization. So we go after illegal activities, primarily on the high seas, illegal whaling, illegal fishing, destruction of habitats, that sort of thing. And we're effective because we're operating in an area where there are laws, but there is no law enforcement, so we become that law enforcement. And so we've been doing what we've been doing for three decades, and even though it's considered what we do to be quite radical, we've never been convicted of a crime, and, you know, we've never hurt anybody, but we have shut down some major, you know, whaling, fishing, sealing operations worldwide.
And you've been thrown in jail a few times. I mean, you really have had to make a very deep commitment to this work.
Well, I think anybody who's ever accomplished anything in the world has been thrown in jail a few times, but we've never been convicted.
And why did you originally break up with Greenpeace? Can you explain that?
I was one of the co-founders of Greenpeace. I left Greenpeace in 77 because I actually got tired of seeing whales die. I haven't seen a single whale die ever since we set up Sea Shepherd. I think it takes more than hanging banners and taking photographs. You got to directly intervene, and that's what we do. We're an interventionist organization, not a protest organization. We're also a volunteer grassroots organization, and I want to keep it that way. The problem with the mainstream is that when grassroots become mainstream, the mainstream becomes stronger, and corporations simply just put a power plant on it and raise more money. It makes the establishment much stronger in their approach on that. I think that the real backbone of the conservation environmental movement is the passion, the courage, and the imagination, and the integrity of grassroots volunteers around the world.
And Michelle, do you think that the approach of the Sierra Club can be reconciled with the approach of the Sea Shepherd, for example?
I think they're very different. I mean, while I spend a lot of time lobbying and working on environmental policy, Sea Shepherd is out there doing great work to physically stand in the way of people that are really committing crimes on the environment.
And I'd like to ask each of you about how the politics of today compare to 1970, say. But first, let me invite our listeners to join us in this conversation about the environmental movement and what direction it should be going in. You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And if you're doing something out in the community, if you're doing environmental activism, let us know what you're doing and what the effect is. And is it time to retire Earth Day, or can it be reclaimed? How did you spend Earth Day? And does it provide a real opportunity to talk about our relationship to the Earth and how we should be transforming it? What are the most powerful ways to observe Earth Day? You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. All right, so let's start. Mark, do you want to start talking about this? And I want to bring Michelle and Paul into it. Can we talk about the politics of environmentalism today versus in 1970? You talked about the fact that there was enormous grassroots pressure to change things. And now, pretty much on the political campaign, nobody's talking about environmentalism. They're talking about oil, but there's not a whole lot else that's being talked about. So can you just give us a little bit of a snapshot?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Republicans, just one caveat to that. You know, the Republicans did talk about climate change. It's odd. You know, they're the ones who talk about it to dismiss it, to describe it as a liberal hoax and so forth. And it's now, that's part of the litmus test that you have to pass as a Republican candidate, not just for president, by the way, but in 2010, all of the Republicans who were elected to the House when they took control of the House, at least publicly, say that they don't believe in man-made climate change. So there's no question that there's a real choice there. Not that the Democrats have provided such strong leadership, but at least the Democrats believe in climate science. Now, that said, you're right. They're not talking about it on the campaign trail. The perception, apparently, within the Obama White House is that it doesn't help to talk about climate change. They want to reach these perhaps mythical independent centrist voters, and their polling and focus groups supposedly tell them that the way to do that is to talk not about climate change, but about clean energy. And the president has even gone a step further now and talked about all of the above as his energy strategy. He even went so far a couple weeks ago as to stand in front of a vast stack of oil pipes and brag about how his administration has increased domestic drilling for oil more than any previous administration, and they laid enough pipe to encircle the earth and so forth. And that's clearly his way of trying to defang Republican attacks on gas prices and so forth. In fact, all of the above, that slogan was a Republican slogan that Obama took from them. What's been interesting to me is that he has not gotten much pushback on this from either the media or the environmental groups. Nobody in the media, for example, aside from the piece that I wrote in The Nation, has pointed out that, you know, all of the above as an energy strategy completely contradicts all of his stated on the record promises to take climate change seriously, to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions over time. Those are impossible to square. And it's not only the media that's not pointing that out. I'm sorry to say that even environmentalists are not really saying that. Indeed, they went out, including the Sierra Club, I'm sure Michelle can speak to this, and endorsed the president, the earliest endorsement in history. Why would you do that?
So let's turn that over to Michelle. So the Sierra Club just recently endorsed, along with three other organizations, endorsed President Obama. Why do it at all? What is it about the Obama administration's policies that you're endorsing, and why so early?
I think that when you look at the alternatives, when you look at the attacks on the EPA, you know, and other Republican policies that we've seen in the past few years, we really need to think about holding on to what we have and, you know, throwing weight behind the president at this stage to make sure we don't get someone a heck of a lot worse. And I'm really sorry to have to say that. I was outraged when I read that article in the New York Times where Obama's speaking in front of the pipelines, guaranteeing to bring jobs there. I did post it on our Facebook page talking about, you know, pandering in this way. It won't be appreciated. And then the National Sierra Club did endorse just a few weeks later. And I was a little surprised, but I understand, you know, when we look at politics at a national level, what recourse do we have? And I also understand that's why, you know, some environmental organizations have taken to doing more extreme actions to have direct impact in protecting the environment. You know, when you're playing political games, which I think is necessary, it's not, you have to rely on politicians to make good decisions, and that doesn't always happen, unfortunately.
And to the other question, Michelle, you know, the Sierra Club's been around since, I think, 1892. So how have you seen the mission and actions of the Sierra Club and other organized environmental groups change and evolve, you know, in the 70s to now?
Honestly, I haven't been organizing for the Sierra Club since the 70s. I've only been organizing for a few years here, so I'm not sure if I can really speak to that entirely. And the Sierra Club was founded, you know, to create the Park Service, to really do land conservation, which I think, you know, we kind of go back to that a little bit in that, you know, we know how to fight that battle, and it's a valuable battle to fight. And, you know, when we think about, you can communicate with people the wonderful natural resources that we have in this country and how they need to be protected. There's not a lot of controversy there. We're able to move forward with that, and it has great impact on all aspects of environmental conservation, from carbon sequestration to preserving habitat for species, to making sure that forests remain intact. You know, so I would say that in some ways we really stick to our traditional values, and we still try to get people out there in the outdoors. We lead, you know, there's volunteers leading hikes throughout the Bay Area and throughout the country every single day, and several on the weekends. So we're really, I think, still maybe a household name, and that organization that really tries to court more of the mainstream and bring, you know, parents and teachers and people that are, you know, very mainstream America into environmental conservation.
All right, Paul, you actually have been around and been active since the 70s. How have you seen the political climate and the political conversation evolve?
Well, I think that the strength of any movement has to lie in diversity, and right across the board, from a conservative approach to what's so-called radical approach. I mean, I was even a national director of the Sierra Club myself. But politically, there is no diversity. I mean, we got Republicans or Republicans, really. I mean, it's you know, it's just a light form of the previous administration, really, from what I can see. Mark is right. The last environmental president was Richard Nixon, including Clinton Gore. They just wouldn't touch this stuff. It's been very, very frustrating, because there's really no choice politically in this country to you know, to have a real alternative. And that's too bad. I mean, President Obama has stabbed us in the back more than George Bush has on all these ocean conservation issues. So we're extremely disappointed in him. The only criticism I would have with the Sierra Club is that when I was in the Sierra Club, it was sort of an attitude of the Democrats, right or wrong. And I'm hoping that will change and that they'll speak out more critically against this administration.
Well, very quickly, because we need to go to a break, Michelle mentioned, you know, that progressives increasingly, well, these are my words, you know, are feeling entrenched and just trying to hold on to what we already have. And that seems to be where we are in 2012.
I think that really the strength has to come from the grassroots. And I'm really glad to see that there are so many small organizations and individuals coming to the forefront, and real activism is beginning to take place all over the world. And that activism is inspired by a passion by individuals who are seeing what is happening to this planet and know that that we have to take some sort of positive, turn this into a positive direction.
And that's
happening, especially amongst young people.
That's Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd. We're also speaking with Michelle Myers, conservation director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Sierra Club, and Mark Hertzgard, environmental journalist and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. We want you to join our conversation, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco, where we have been broadcasting since 1941. Now with online listening, we have listeners worldwide. But just because you live in the Bay Area doesn't mean that KALW's online streams are not for you as well. If you hear KALW at work but not at home or lose reception on your commute, check out the online listening options at kalw.org. Whether you're on your desktop, your tablet, or your smartphone, you can stay connected. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of kalw.org. And thank you for supporting your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about poetry. What role does poetry play in your life? To honor Poem in Your Pocket Day and National Poetry Month, we'll be having a conversation about how poetry relates to our everyday lives. How can it inspire, motivate, inform, and transform individuals and society? Friday, of course, is our media roundtable. That's the day we speak with journalists about the week's coverage. And on Monday, we'll ask what's happening with our weather. We've now had one of the warmest winters on record, including the hottest March ever in the lower 48. Here in California, we've had an unusually dry winter, and it's been predicted by global warming models. So what's the relationship between the weather and long-term climate change? And what can we expect from the weather in the future? Today, we're talking about Earth Day. Is it effective? We're reflecting on Earth Day and how it might help or hinder real environmental progress. Is it time to retire Earth Day, or can we reform it? Can it provide a real opportunity to talk about our relationship to the Earth and how we begin to transform it? And that's the question we're putting to you. You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And you can now post comments at our new website, which is yourcallradio.org. And one of our guests said, you know, at this point, we're just holding on to what we have. Do you think that the environmental movement needs to stay inside of the mainstream, or do we need to act outside of it? 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 to join our conversation. And if you're doing environmental activism, we'd love to hear what it is that you're up to. 866-798-8255. Our guests today are Mark Hertzgard, environmental journalist and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, Michelle Myers, who's conservation director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Sierra Club, and Paul Watson, who's founder of the Sea Shepherd. And let's now go to calls. Let's go to Ed in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi, how are you? Hey, campaign finance reform. Campaign finance reform. Everybody say it together now. Campaign finance reform.
Well, what about Citizens United?
Oh, definitely Citizens United, yes. And thank you so much, Paul Watson. Thank you. The whales, thank you. I thank you. Should we continue? Of course. We've got to keep the pressure happening. It's kind of like between the lock pickers and the lock makers, or the cops and the robbers. They change, we change. They change, we change. However, part B, you only make the gains when you, like, double your strength or triple your strength, like when the big thing happened, when Earth Day Camp happened, the big push. But like the lady said about the educational part, that's essential. What me and my people are doing is just a thing to see if there's radioactivity on the streets in Berkeley. I want to say that conservative, I like that. I think we should occupy conservative. Reclaim Republicans, that's a little far, but maybe. I mean, that's an alternative. I know somebody in Michigan who got elected in that way. So I think there's a certain amount of churning that we just have to stay present with the issue. But then we got to push. So.
Well, thank you so much, Ed. Let's go to Scott in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Call, Scott. Scott in Berkeley, you're on Your Call.
Hi. Sorry, I'm stuck my headset.
It's okay.
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about Earth Day as Earth Day approached, and I was remembering I was actually there in the original Earth Day. And
where?
It does seem to have lost some of its teeth, I think in part because, you know, the original Earth Day, young activists were also threatened by the Vietnam War and by the draft, and everybody was quite mobilized. Now it's a little bit different. But on this Earth Day, I took part in the Occupy the Farm situation out at the Gill Tract at Marin and San Pablo in Albany. 300 activists marched onto this property that's been, I think, kind of ambivalently held by the University of California, Berkeley. It used to be about 100 acres. It seems that they've parsed off 90% of that for development, and this is apparently Class 1 agricultural land, which I guess is the best organic land left in the East Bay. There's, I think, about 10 acres, and 300 people went out there and just said, we're going to start planting crops. They had 15,000 starter plants donated by local nurseries. They've got chickens, and it's an Occupy situation, very different from the urban Occupy situation.
And what's the status now of the farm?
They're farming every day. They're out there farming. They intend to farm. If the police come, they intend to keep farming. And there's about 70 people staying each night in a little tent city out there. So it's quite extraordinary. You can Google Occupy the Farm, or their website is Take Back the Tract.
And Scott, what is it? We'll have links to that at yourcallradio.org. Okay. What is it that got you inspired to join the Occupy the Farm movement?
Well, just the fact that, I mean, I'm a gardener, and I'm from the Midwest, where a lot of people used to garden. Still garden, obviously. I appreciate good, wholesome food, but there's also something about developing land which has been agricultural for, you know, centuries. And why should we lose that when people are hungry? I think actually part of the plan is to develop a Whole Foods market there, which is great. You know, I shop at Whole Foods, but why not actually grow food that people can be involved in the process from, you know, beginning to end?
And brings people together in community. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Scott. Scott brought up something that I'd like to hear your comments on, Mark, Paul, and Michelle, which is he talked about the political climate in the 70s when you had soldiers and anti-war activists, when you had the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the gay rights movement, all of these different movements happening in concert. Another thing that's happened over that past 40-year period is the widest gap between rich and poor since the 1920s. Do you think that there's some relation to the fact that there was so much social and economic upheaval at the time, and now people maybe do feel entrenched because they're economically stressed? I don't know. I'm just put that out to all of you.
It's clear, pardon me, it's clear that Nixon certainly felt embattled by that activism. And I wouldn't call it upheaval. That is what grassroots organizing is. We tend to think of politics in this country as voting. And too much of the environmental movement, at least the modern environmental movement, thinks that, okay, you go to Washington, and if you've got the strongest arguments and the shiniest report, you should win. And that was true in the 70s because they had still the advantage of having scared the bejesus out of the politicians. But anybody today who thinks that the smartest arguments win in Washington is committing political malpractice. That's basic politics, that what happens in Washington is about power, and it's about whether you can punish your opponents and reward your friends. And the environmental movement, and its modern incarnation, simply no longer has that power because it's not strong enough at the grassroots. And that, I think, is the real lesson between these two times. But, you know, on the positive side, the caller mentioned Occupy. The Occupy movement is now beginning to reintroduce these kinds of issues and to scare the bejesus out of the politicians, which is good. We want to scare them. Politicians are not your friends. They are supposed to be your employees, right? This is a democracy, but they are inevitably pressured a lot by the powerful. The main reason that we have not been able to get for example, climate legislation, is that corporations have undue influence in Washington. That is a central focus of the Occupy movement. And so one of the things that I think is very potentially hopeful is if we see the Occupy movement and the environmental movement coming together with that kind of a critique and with that kind of commitment to grassroots organizing. Tip O'Neill, the great former Speaker of the House of Representatives, once said, all politics is local, meaning that's where political power comes from. If you've got the member of Congress scared that they can't win re-election in their local district, they will listen to you.
And that's Mark Hertzgard. He's an environmental journalist, and you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And I want to get to more callers, but first I want to give Paul and Michelle a chance to weigh in on those questions that Scott brought up. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, well, there are three basic laws of ecology. The first is the law of diversity. The strength of an ecosystem is dependent upon diversity. The second is the law of interdependence, that all of the species are interdependent. And the third is the law of finite resources. There's a limit to growth. And in 1972, I attended the United Nations Conference on the Environment in Stockholm. And the number one issue on the agenda that year was out of control human population growth. And now nobody even wants to talk about it. That goes right into the law of finite resources. There are simply not enough resources on this planet to continue to support an ever-expanding population. And therefore, the disparity between rich and poor is only going to get larger. And nobody wants to talk about it. And that, I think, is one of the great tragedies, where in 1972, on Earth Day, it was a priority issue. Now it is all non-existent.
Why do you think that is?
Because everybody's afraid to bring it up because for political reasons. When we brought it up in the Sierra Club a few years ago, we were just trying to return to the original policies. We were actually accused of racism. We're talking numbers here. We're not talking about ethnic groups or anything. And the problem is there's just simply too many people. And when I was born, there were 3 billion people on the planet. There's now 7 billion. And when is that going to end? It has to end somewhere. We have to come up with a comprehensive program to voluntarily bring these populations down. And if we don't, the future is going to be very, very bleak indeed.
Well, and I think, Paul, to be fair, some of the criticisms against that were that you've also got to look at who is consuming the most resources and look at that equation in that way. So it's not just that you have to bring population down, you also have to bring consumption down, particularly in the developing world where it's the highest. I mean, that's my understanding.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that, too. But, you know, even in places like Madagascar, where you have third world people, say, have over populated their carrying capacity, and that leads to the destruction of species. So therefore, the diminishment of biodiversity on this planet, I think, is even more serious than global warming. It's going to reach a point where it's going to crash, and our numbers are going to contribute to that crash.
And Michelle, did you want to comment on anything that's been said, or Scott's comments, which I believe he started with political campaign reform?
Actually, I wanted to comment a little bit on the grassroots movement and the Occupy movement. I am also very excited by the Occupy movement. I think that the fact that we do have public outrage and people in the streets reinvigorating that exactly what it means to be political, and when the politicians are not serving the masses through environmental policy, social policy, economic policy, that there is an imbalance in the way our government works. And as far as organizing in the grassroots, you know, I think that, you know, we talk about the Sierra Club as being this big green organization that's a national organization and is doing a lot of work on a national level. Specifically, my job is to do work on a local level. You know, I've worked with Occupy to organize a prayer vigil outside of the Canadian consulate to protest tar sands. You know, I've participated in Occupy events, and there is an Occupy Oakland actually has an environmental committee now that just to work on environmental policy. I work with a variety of environmental nonprofits that are all coming up with climate action coalitions to influence local governments, the city of Berkeley, the city of Oakland, the city of San Francisco, to really implement ways to reduce our carbon footprint on a local level. So when you're talking about grassroots activism, it isn't just people getting out there in the streets and protesting. It's actually affecting local policy. And that's really the value of Earth Day, is when you go out and are able to raise consciousness about what's happening on a local level, what's really happening in the grassroots in their backyard, and things that they can actually impact. Because you know what? Yeah. Washington is really, really hard to affect. You need to have a lot of money. You need to have the best arguments and the best people to communicate those arguments. And you know what? Sometimes you still lose. But you know what? When you have politicians that actually are from the same mindset as you, when you can go to the Berkeley City Council and say, you know what? Why don't we have a grocery store shuttle bus so that people aren't driving to the grocery store or driving to the farmer's market where we're able to purchase locally produced organic food, but we still have a, you know, have to use our cars to get it to and from our homes. Simple things like that are actually where we can make the biggest difference, and that's where people actually can be really empowered directly. And that's where I think the power of grassroots activism needs to go. It's consciousness raising, it's organizing, and it's bringing people together, not just to impact what's happening in D.C., but what's happening right here in our own backyards.
And that's Michelle Myers with the Sierra Club. And let's go now to Ashoka Finley, who was one of the organizers of Occupy the Farm, which we just heard a caller, Scott, talk about. Hi, Ashoka.
Hi, Holly.
Hi. So tell us about creating this Occupy the Farm movement and what's going on now.
Okay, so this Occupy the Farm movement is kind of a response to, in many ways, what my generation sees as a failure of social movements of past times. We saw a need to do something more radical, quite frankly. We have watched the history of a lot of these topics be talked about for 40 years, and I don't think the question gets asked often enough of why it hasn't happened yet. Why is climate change still an issue that isn't even up for debate? Why is, as one of the panelists was saying earlier, why don't we even talk about the needs of to educate people in family planning so that we don't have as large of population growth? Why haven't we curbed consumption yet? Why is there still a throwaway culture in developed societies? And so these questions not being asked produced a lot of frustration, especially in my generation. Most of the organizers of Occupy the Farm are in their 20s. And so 6 months ago, someone had the idea. It was like, well, why don't we just take the last class one agriculture land left in the Bay Area, turn it into a sustainable organic farm in which we can self-organize and autonomously produce food for free, addressing problems of food scarcity and food deserts. The East Bay has plenty of food deserts. I personally live in Richmond. I teach urban agriculture at a high school there, and I see every day the food that the youth are given. And so in response to that, we've been planning for 6 months to take back the tract. And so we organized completely autonomously, organized the greenhouse starts. You know, we planted brassicas, which are broccoli, kale, and cauliflower, you know, 6 months ago, starting them in the greenhouse. And so we want to show that this is a model that is replicable. And we want to show that, you know, this is the easiest land that we can do this on. This land has never had any chemical dumping. This land doesn't have any heavy metals. But if we're going to develop urban sustainability and urban agriculture, we're going to need to find a model of best practices that we can encourage throughout the East Bay and the world. And that's going to require taking over things that have been polluted. And so it's time to start really looking into that seriously. Go ahead.
Ashoka, I just wanted to ask you about some of the challenges. The land is owned by UC Berkeley, and didn't they shut off the water to the farm?
Yeah, so the land is public land, which is managed by UC Berkeley.
Okay.
It is part of a larger land grant that was given in, I believe, 1928. By a gentleman of last name Gill, and it was originally in 104 acres, and this is the last 10 and a half. Right now we are occupying about 5.3, which is really the last farmland. The rest of the 10 acres does have some buildings on it, and some old greenhouses were raised there. The UC did shut off the water, but it's an example of dealing with the challenges that we have. And so we autonomously organize, and we have people that actually bring us water tanks. And, I mean, it's an exercise in learning how to farm with water scarcity, right? So we use the water tanks to water in seedlings, but a lot of things can actually be dry farmed. I mean, we have five rows of tomatoes year that will be dry farmed in order to conserve water. We need to stop farming and producing food like we're never going to run out of resources. We need to figure out alternative ways of food production that deal with the problem of resource scarcity.
And Ashoka, a couple of our guests mentioned the inspiration of Occupy and the hope that Occupy would marry with environmental activism, and it seems like that's exactly what you've done.
Yes. I think in the viewpoint of a lot of us, the future is sustainable or there is no future. And that's pretty much what it comes down to. And so there's a lot of people who are talking about what right do they have to take this land? This belongs to someone else. But it's no longer about doing what you have the right to do, but rather doing what's right. And so the legal system and the system of political economic organization that we currently have that says you can't farm this land is the same system that has cultivated a petroleum dependency, that cultivates oil wars, that cultivates corruption. And so when the police tell us that we have to leave, they are protecting this past that has gotten to this crucial and critical point of every crisis that we can possibly imagine, whether that be social, economic, ecological, health, and they are protecting that, which is crazy to us because there's no way that you can look at the crisis we have now and on the scale we have and say that we need more of the same. How could you ever say that and think about the future generations? I mean, a lot of people who participated in the environmental movement, 40 years ago and have continued to participate in it, they aren't the people that are really going to inherit the world. They aren't the people that are going to be living in 2050 when we're projected to have 10 billion people. They aren't the people that are going to be living in the world when we have running out of fresh water. These processes have been ongoing, of course, and so we are out here planting the future.
And Ashoka, before you go, our conversation is a little bit about Earth Day and the significance of it. So why did you decide to do this Occupy the Farm on Earth Day, and how important was it as a symbol for you?
Earth Day is an amazing symbol. I mean, in the 70s, obviously, there was much more participation in direct action globally. It's a global call, which makes it very effective in terms of a rallying cry of let's shed these differences that have stopped us from working together for so long, and let's come together to find sustainable solutions. And I think that's what Earth Day represents. It's a celebration of the home that we all inhabit and the only home that we have. I think that, every day should be Earth Day. Obviously, we shouldn't really celebrate the Earth only one day a year. And I think Earth Day needs to transform back into what it was. I think there is a little too much pageantry and not enough direct action. And so that's why Occupy the Farm chose that day. Another consideration was the landless peasant struggle, the Movimiento Sin Tierra, that is going on in Central and Latin America and also South America. And they actually sent us a statement of solidarity in Portuguese about how they are very, they stand in solidarity with us, and they are excited that we chose this week because this week is an anniversary of basically a bunch of their activists got murdered in the early 90s working for land reform.
And so this is a way to connect your struggle with the global struggle. Ashoka, I'm going to have to let you go just because we're running out of time and I want to get one more caller on here. Thank you so much. And we'll put a link to Occupy the Farm at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. Let's go now to Julia in San Francisco. Hi, Julia. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi, Holly. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Thanks for this great discussion. My question should dovetail nicely with Ashoka's comments. And to bring the conversation a little bit back to where it started about the value of Earth Day, this morning in my neighborhood I saw young people with little garbage pickers, little plastic garbage pickers, picking up cigarette butts and cups and bags of chips in the street. And I thought, well, that's sort of cute. And then my second thought was, that makes me kind of sad. because, you know, on the one day of the year that they're taught to love the earth, they're basically potentially being taught that loving the earth means cleaning up after the rest of us. And I sort of wanted to ask you guys what you thought about the kinds of messages they might be receiving the rest of the days of the year and what they should be taught in school.
So, Julia, let me just throw that then to the panel just because we're running out of time. Mark, how do you think kids should be taught about these issues and what kind of actions are appropriate for young people?
Kids get it. They don't need a whole lot of extra teaching. They come to life with a sense that animals matter. Why do you think kids love animals so much? They relate to them. And while I understand the caller's concern, it's also the case that everybody has a different entry point for getting involved in this. And for some people, maybe I remember hearing from somebody who in 1970, you know, they went down and they picked up trash, and that was how they began to understand the relationship to the natural world. So there's a lot of entry points, and Paul said earlier, you know, diversity. Every social movement needs diversity. But the main thing is, if you're listening out there and you didn't do anything, that's the biggest problem. I'll close by quoting, since it's Poetry Week, the greatest environmental poet, Dr. Seuss, who writes in The Lorax, at the end of The Lorax, which is now out in movie form if you prefer, unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not.
And there we have Dr. Seuss, also wrote that great environmental book, The Lorax for Kids. I got an email from Mark in Berkeley. He said, one of the great functions of Earth Day is to educate young people, and that opportunity never ends. 39 years ago, my junior high had study groups and booths from outside organizations and businesses. The local health food store brought samples of granola and educated us about whole grains. On the spot, I converted from Captain Crunch to granola. 14 years later, I went to vegetarian. I think about how many really effective seeds were planted by that guy so long ago and see how hugely important it is to get basic information out to hungry minds. And we're going to go ahead and end it there. We've been joined by Mark Hertzgard, environmental journalist and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, Michelle Myers, who's the conservation director for the San Francisco Bay chapter of the Sierra Club, and Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd. We'll have all of those that information at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What role does poetry play in your life? On the next Your Call, we'll honor Poem in Your Pocket Day and National Poetry Month by speaking with poets. How can poetry inspire, motivate, inform, and transform individuals and society? If you've only recently discovered poetry, what opened your eyes to it? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What poem or poet is your favorite and why? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.